Welcome, everybody, to another edition of the On the Forecheck podcast. It's the off season, folks. A lot to talk about today. I'm Nick Morgan, joined as always by the donkey to my Shrek, Sean Smith. Sean.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going fantastic. And big news today, Sean, because we have a Puss in Boots to join Donkey and Shrek this week.
Oh, man. You really, really just, I don't know.
On the Forecheck fans know him very well. He's currently writing for A to Z Sports. Alex Doherty. Alex.
Hey, how's it going? I think I'm probably more like Lord Farquaad, maybe.
Ooh. No, you don't get to choose. I've noticed with Nick, he just kind of gives it to you and you just have to take it. It's really uncomfortable. I don't enjoy it at all, but it's whatever.
You have better flow, better hair flow than Lord Farquaad, though.
So. Okay. All right. So take he has out. Pretty good flow, so I must be doing pretty good.
He does. That's a big compliment. So,
yeah, thanks for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to have you. I wish we had better stuff to talk about, but it's not been the best weeks headline-wise for the Nashville Predators. Obviously, we got some playoff stuff to talk to, but we'll start with the big news of today, and that is that the NHL put out the Vezina Trophy finalist. UC Saros, not on there, not one of the three. I think we speak for everybody when I say maybe a long shot to win the whole thing, but bit of a surprise that he wasn't one of the top three. And Alex, I've been on your Twitter. I know you feel some strong way about this.
Yeah, I mean, I was honestly like pretty shocked that he wasn't on there. I mean, the name that stood out on that list to me that should not have been on there is Philip Grubauer, and he's had a fine season. But I thought, and now I can't even remember who the other finalists are, but I guess is it Grubauer, Vasilevsky, and Marc-Andre Fleury? Is that right?
That is correct. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Fleury doesn't surprise me just because he was, you know, such a workhorse for Vegas all year. And they were very good, and you know he's the guy, but then he like doesn't even get a start. They sat him in the playoff game. I thought that was interesting, but Fleury and Vasilevsky make sense. I just like UC Saros is like so clearly been better than Philip Grubauer all season. Grubauer getting the benefit of playing on probably the Stanley Cup winning team. I mean, I think he had 29 wins this year. I think Saros had like 21. That's about the only category that he beat him in. I mean, like every other category: goals saved above average, overall save percentage, 5-on-5 save percentage, high danger save percentage, all that stuff. Saros is better than Grubauer. He's also better than the other two. Yeah. But yeah, it's so stupid, man. I don't
exactly. Yeah.
It's so stupid because the GMs vote on Vezina Trophy. They look at basically wins and shutouts, and then they just like ask around, hey, who's been good? And since Nashville wasn't very good most of the season, they didn't talk about UC Saros. So it's very silly.
Yeah, I'm not going to say I'm surprised. And when I look at the wording for who wins the Vezina Trophy, it's the goaltender who's adjudged to be the best at this position. And I have to say, you know, Alex threw out a lot of different stats where Saros was leading the competition. But the reality is, you know, you're going to get judged on your wins. And if you are the most valuable or the best at your position, then your team should be winning more when you're in the net, I suppose, is how they're looking at it. I'm not saying I agree with it, but it's, you know, like, how deep do you really think they're going to go in this? Well, my guy's got 30 wins. He should clearly be up there. It's probably, you know, the most realistic way that meeting goes, you know, like, oh, your guy has 21 wins. So why should he be there? We got guys with 30, yeah. 29, 28. It's not happening. Sorry, David Poile, sit down. So I'm afraid that as much as we can make that argument about all of these other stats where Saros is, you know, definitely in the front of that race, it's just not going to happen until you have the wins.
That's true, but the wins thing, look, I looked at that too, and like while wins obviously corresponds very high to being a finalist, it doesn't determine the winner always. So like, it's not just as simple as, okay, well, who had the most wins, they get the Vezina. It's not like the Rocket Richard Trophy, it's just who had the most goals. It's different. Like there has to be other factors they're looking at. I mean, like there's a reason why it's not just straight across the board the wins leader every year wins the Vezina. See, that didn't happen. And I don't know what the factors are that they also look at. I mean, they must be looking at something else. I think it's shutouts. I think they look at shutouts and wins. I think they probably glance at save percentage. They probably glance at save percentage and then are like, yeah, maybe this guy should be in there. I bet Soros gets fourth. I bet he's like right on the cusp. I think he probably finishes fourth in voting. That's my guess.
Will they show that at the end of everything?
Yeah. They put all the votes. Yeah. Everyone who got votes.
I'm curious. I mean, I guess if you look at skaters, you know, realistically, we all know, and I'm sure Brian would agree that plus minus is the king of stats for skaters. So I'm sure that if you go with that same logic, I feel like he's going to show up at my house and beat me physically.
Just start preaching goals against average. There you go. He might just pop up.
No, boy. But here's the thing. I think for goalies, the king of stats is wins and losses. So that's probably how they're looking at that, too.
Yeah. Well, I know Alex mentioned shutouts, and everybody's pointing. I think Grubauer had either 7 or 8. I can't remember the exact number.
That's probably what did it.
And Saros only had 3. But at the same time, if you're voting on this, what's more impressive, stopping 20 of 20 shots like Grubauer or stopping 44 of 45 like Saros did for many nights? He didn't get the shutout, but he made like 44 saves consistently.
Yeah, one of the reasons that Colorado got so many shutouts is because they ran out of pucks because Colorado's offense was putting them all in the other net.
Yeah.
Having three guys who could reasonably win a Norris trophy in the next 5 years probably helps the defensive stats too. But like you said, Sean, I think it's going to be really interesting to see where Saros did wind up when those votes came out. You know, I do think he finished fourth. And on the other side, I do think there is an argument for all three guys who made the finalists. I'm just not saying I totally agree with that argument. I do think Saros was one of the three best goalies. And by the end of the year, I don't really think you can deny it.
I would agree with that statement. I think you could say he's one of the three best goalies, especially if you're looking at the back half of the season. But, you know, they're going to say that it's the whole season long kind of thing and whatever. But, you know, what's important is that everybody had a good time and someone's going to win a trophy.
Well, speaking of everybody had a good time, what a season for the Nashville Predators, huh? I think we went through about 10 years worth of storylines just in the past 5 months. We had a rebuild in there somewhere. We had a late season playoff run, four overtimes, just everything in between. But, and I want to ask you guys, and Alex, I'll ask you first. Now that we've had, you know, a couple of days to sit back, reflect, really digest everything this year, what are your thoughts on this season? How do you judge this?
Okay. So, I really try not to get into the success or failure binary choice there. I know that's not what you're asking, but in the interest of appealing to that crowd, I think anytime you make the playoffs is a success, and I would stand really firm on that no matter what. I think any season you make the playoffs is a success. So in that regard, I think it was a good season. They did some things that, okay. So like the biggest thing, for example, I think that they accomplished this year is they firmly established that, well, two things. They firmly established one that they are going to move on from the Laviolette system. And they've found a system that I think they are okay with. And I think we'll talk about John Hines, but I think that they've gotten back towards like having a team identity that makes sense. I know, Sean, you've heard a lot of John Hines talking about that. And I think that's a big part of it. I mean, don't discredit that as an accomplishment for this season because of how awful of a place this team was in when Laviolette was fired. Like they didn't know what they were. And so I think like they accomplished that. They got that sort of like team identity back. The other thing is that I think one reason it's also a success is they've answered probably the biggest question that's been on everyone's mind for the last like 3 years. And that's, you know, what's going to happen with this goalie transition, this from Pekka to UC Saros? Can Saros do it? Can Pekka be okay hanging it up, or is he going to drag his feet? And like that, all of his questions answered completely this year. Saros is the guy. He's the guy moving forward. Pecorine probably leaving. Even if he's a backup, he won't be really a big part of the team. That's been established. It's not easy for that to happen, by the way. In sports, like we've seen it across a lot of different sports, it's not always, doesn't always happen where like the incumbent is just like willing to make it happen. And then the young guy is good enough to carry the torch. So that's a big accomplishment too. Those are the two things that I think I could take away from this season, finding their identity and establishing UC Soros as the goalie moving forward.
Well, yeah. First off, you know, Alex, you said something that really kind of struck me was that any year or any season where you make the playoffs is a successful season. I would, you know, I'd sign on to that completely. I don't know if the people in Toronto would sign on to that completely, but at least for Nashville, I'm going to say, yes, they made the playoffs, even though they put on a good show in the playoffs. It was a good fight, successful season in that sense. If I go back to the beginning of the season, we talked about how, you know, look, at this point, you could finish anywhere from seventh to second in this division. And if you end up going to the playoffs, and that would kind of be the benchmark for success. I would say it's successful in that sense. However, yeah, I think you've answered those questions about the goaltender situation. And I think back, you know, Alex, you said it was, that doesn't always happen easily. And I think back to the captaincy transition between Mike Fisher and Roman Josi, with Fisher coming back toward the end of the next season. And that was a situation, if you're looking for an example, perfect situation to look at, because you had someone, the outgoing captain, leave and then talk very quickly about coming back when the team was seeing success. And then that already, a lot of people already like to complain about Roman Josi's leadership for some reason, I guess because he's not as loud and angry on the ice or something. But
he's too Swiss.
Too Swiss. You know, he's in the Swiss remain neutral or something, World War II. I don't know. But the reality is, I think that Fisher's coming back, even though, like we said, wasn't really a big part of the team when he came back, it complicated that transition of power.
He was terrible when he came back. You can say it.
Yeah, well, he was. I think anybody would have my back on that. But, you know, the reality is, even though he was bad, I think it made that situation worse for Roman Josi. And I think it allowed a lot. Oh, well, I'm glad Fisher's coming back because he's going to get that team in order like Josi didn't or something. I mean, all stupid arguments, but they were all things I heard quite frequently when he returned. And so you're really lucky and fortunate that, you know, everyone's always said from the start that Pecorine is a world-class human being. And you're seeing that, you know, even more so as he has been very, very gracious in this transition of goaltending, you know, the goaltender spot to UC Soros. And it just really backs up what everybody said all along about him off the ice. It's always been the same on the ice, but now you see him in this transitional stage of his career, it still holds true.
So let me ask you guys this. When we had the late run, I mean, obviously, if we flash back to where we were in March, we were talking about rebuild. Alex, I think you and I both put out pieces that basically said it's happening. We were both wrong on that. But I'll ask you this. Do you feel better now about the future of this team than you did, let's say, back in March?
I definitely do. I would feel better about this team. I think there's more layers to it than that too. I think you have to feel better about this team going back to the Dallas Stars series in 2019. They were not even really competitive in that series. I mean, they won a couple games. It went to six games, but they were like not really that competitive. And Dallas eventually went to the Stanley Cup final, but. No, I'm sorry. That was the year after. That year they didn't. they're significantly better from that day, and then they're better now than they were at the beginning of the season. I think you have to feel pretty good about it moving forward. It obviously depends on what happens in the offseason, which we're going to talk about. But again, I think the biggest question, the UC Soros question, is like established, and that's one of your biggest pieces of your team moving forward, and that's been covered. Like they're good there. Now they have to solve some of their cap issues and figure out what they're going to do with Seattle and maybe move some pieces around. But yeah, I think you have to feel better.
Oh, I feel like I've done a lot of talking and writing and tweeting and whatevering about the fact that I think the team's in a much better spot than they were. I mean, there's no doubt. I know at one point I made an impassioned plea on the radio to not cheer for a tank. And so, you know,
a lot of us did.
Well, yeah, I mean, a lot of us did. But, you know, you're going from the extreme of saying, hey, guys, don't cheer for a tank. You want this team to do well, and here's why, to the team doing well. And I think it's very easy to see the results of that. So, you know, realistically here, what you're looking at is a team that has gone from needing a total teardown and rebuild to a team that maybe just needs to make some painful cuts, I guess you could say, at least cuts that would be painful to the fan base, and move forward with kind of the bolstered youth presence that has managed to manifest itself on the team, despite Poile doing everything he could in free agency to make that not happen.
Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little bit, because that was the headline going into last offseason, was David Poile kind of hinted, hey, we're going to bring some of these guys who've been in Milwaukee, we're going to bring them up, and we're going to give them a shot. And then when, you know, Nick Cousins and Brad Richardson and Eric Howla came in, I think we're all like, okay, where's Phil Tomasino going to play? Where's Ellie Tolvanen going to play? But he wound up accomplishing the youth movement goal, at least to some extent, because Ellie Tolvin, and I think you can pretty much assume, is going to be a daily part of the lineup next year. Alex Carrier, assuming he's still on the roster, we'll get to that because there is some expansion issues with him. Mm. You know, he's a top four defenseman. I mean, he showed it. Like, he proven it. It's not like a Dante Fabro situation where, you know, he came in, played sparingly, and then was thrown into a top four role. I mean, Carrier came in and was a top four defenseman. And, you know, when I went back and watched his games, there's maybe, you know, the glaring mistakes he made, I could probably count on one hand, which is fantastic for a first year player. And then you also have guys like David Ferentz, Jeremy Davies, who came up and played well. Rem Pitlick, I think, when he was in the lineup, played great. Tanner Janot. I mean, there's all these. And I know, like, everybody's talking about, oh, Poile just lucked into it. But at the end of the day, the Preds got where they wanted to be, and that's have some youth, get their feet wet, prove they can play, and all of a sudden you have all these young players to build around.
Yeah, I've actually gone down this road about the youth movement thing, and I guess I don't feel like trying to rehash all that, because I've tried to make my point so many different times, so many different ways, and I just can't make it clear. But I know what it looks like in my head. But yeah. Essentially, like the youth movement happened simultaneous to some older players also not playing well or being injured. So I don't know. It's hard to explain. But basically, the youth movement happened like alongside a bunch of other things happening that people just kind of ignore. But I think the youth movement's like definitely on the way. I think it's going to be even more now. I mean, I thought that Tomasino would get his debut this year. I don't think that obviously that didn't happen. I don't know where he's going to fit next year. I would assume he gets a pretty solid shot at the roster, but you feel like you'd want to get his debut out of the way first if you're going to do that. So that's kind of confusing. There's going to be a large number of contributors next year that are going to be guys we've seen this year. I mean, Jakob Trenin, Tanner Janot, maybe Matthew Olivier, if they re-sign him, those guys are going to be a big part of it. I doubt Eric Halla is back, because that wouldn't really make a lot of sense, but maybe Nick Cousins already under a contract for next year. Mikael Granlund, maybe they re-sign him. He's only 28. It'll be interesting to see how much younger they get in the offseason.
Agreed. And that's something we're going to have to watch. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because a little bit later, we're going to be talking about individual players and their chances on, like, what percentage chance do we think they're going to be back on the team next year? That's coming up in a little bit. For now, though, let's look back on the Carolina series, because that in itself was kind of a microcosm of the Preds' entire season. Terrible start. You know, even though I think there's some dissent between different people on whether game two was good or not. And then all of a sudden you just kind of see the team do a couple things differently. You flip a switch and the Preds are back in it, made it a series. I don't think anybody can sit here and say that the Preds got killed this series. Probably one of the closer 4-2 series there were. But Sean, I want to ask you this. When you look back, what were kind of the one or two things that you noticed that eventually shifted the favor to Carolina?
Well, you know, the first thing I noticed was the return of Jacob Slavin. You know, they were without him for a while. And once the Predators kind of got going, they looked pretty fierce. And when I heard that Slavin was coming back, I thought to myself, you know, I really hope, you know, we talked so much at the beginning of the series about certain players, you know, being substituted into the lineup for the Predators, not being the difference maker that was going to push the team over in any situation. And I think that held true for the most part. But when I heard that Slavin was back on the ice and was taking warmups, I knew that he could come in and be the one player they could add to that roster that would make the biggest difference. Because I don't think, especially at that position, that Carolina has the depth that the Predators have in any position. And I think that was really on full display going into that third and fourth game. But with Slavin back in, that really shored up that defense. And I think that's what really, you know, I don't want to say that that was the only thing that changed, but that was a big, big difference maker for the Hurricanes, was just adding Slavin back into the lineup.
For me, the the single thing that turned the series and made it more competitive for the Predators was moving Matt Duchene to the top line. When they made that switch, putting Duchene with Johansson and Forsberg going into game three, it was 0-2. They were kind of getting just beaten all up and down the ice in both those games, except for maybe like one period. They needed to change something, and John Hines does that, and it just works. Like, instantly it worked. And then the other thing is, like, when you do something like that in mid-series, you throw this, like, curveball at them that works, then you've switched the dynamic, regardless of what the series record is, like down 0-2 or up 2-0. When you've changed the dynamic of it, and I think Carolina had to do some catching up. I mean, like, Sean's right that, like, getting Slavin back was a big part of it, but even with Slavin in the lineup in game five, they should have won that game. Like, they should have won in regulation. They should have won in overtime. Like, there were number of chances for that team to come out with a win and be up 3-2 going into game six. I think the change from Matt Duchene moving to the top line, giving him finally some line mates that can score, was the biggest factor that turned the series. And then, you know, Carolina got a bounce that went their way, and the series is over.
To me, it speaks to something John Hines said between games three and four, or I'm sorry, between games two and three. Numbers are hard. Don't listen to me. He admitted there's going to be strategy changes. I think he was specifically asked about the power play in that situation, but he said, we're going to change. I can't remember the exact wording, but he basically summarized by saying, we're going to make strategic changes. And that was the first time that I've really heard him say, we're going to change how we do things. You know, when the Predators in the past have kind of run into stuff where maybe us in the media wanted to hear him say, yeah, we're going to change things, and we just kind of wound up with a few personnel changes, you know, a third liner scratched and replaced with another third liner, or, you know, Yarncroke moving up and down the lineup, something like that. This was the first time that I really heard him say, you know what? What I'm doing isn't working. What we're doing isn't working. We have to look at what we're doing. It might not be the personnel. It might be how we're playing. And to me, that was a big moment, because that's accountability from your coaching staff. That's something we don't really hear a whole lot of, really, in any circle around the league. You know, they try to deflect a little bit from what they're doing, you know, try to deflect the players, maybe just say, we need to execute more. This is the first time I've ever really heard John Hines say, we need to change the way we're doing things. And after that, I don't know if that was just a motivation, you know, if that just kick the players into a higher gear, but you could see the difference in strategy between games two and three. I mean, there is a lot more movement on the power play. You know, they're setting things up a little bit differently, a little bit different strategy for forechecking. You can say like all these little things. And that to me, that's, I think, when the series really shifted on its head.
I think, I think you have to be encouraged with John Hines as a coach, with not only how he did in the series, but with certain moments throughout the season. Yes, obviously you can attribute most of the, all of the run really to the play of UC Soros, but I mean, there were other things that got better too. I mean, other things improved, certain players improved their game. Certain key players, I would say Mikal Granlund looked a lot better, in the regular season this year than he did when he first got here. I think Roman Josi obviously is just going to stay the way he stayed, but Ekholm got better. Ellis got better. And you needed those players to get better. And then some of the young guys, like you mentioned, Alex Carrier. I mean, like that guy just basically has established himself as a top four forward or top four defenseman now. So yeah, I think you have to be comfortable with John Hines moving forward because of seeing his adjustments that he's made, not only in a season, but in a series as well.
Sean, I know you're a big John Hines guy. You've been singing his praises a lot during this run.
I am. I think the thing for me about Hines, and I will admit that I have not been covering the team as long as Alex, for example. Especially like being the in the locker room after the game guy, you know, really right toward the end of Laviolette's tenure, I don't have the experience with Laviolette like Alex does, or even with like a lot of the other people that have that access in Nashville. I don't go as far back as they do. So I have to say this knowing that I was there toward the end of his tenure and that it was somewhat contentious, especially with the media at times. I pretty much just kept my mouth shut and just listened because I felt like that would be the best because I didn't want to poke the bear. But something I caught on to with Hines very early on in his tenure with the team was that he was pretty straightforward with things. But he still had the ability when it came to, you know, this is who's going on the ice or this is why I made this decision. He played that pretty close to his chest. And I think, you know, realistically, I think that's okay because you don't want to give too much of, you know, why you're doing what you're doing away because you're kind of tipping your, you know, showing your cards to the other team at that point. But there is a level of accountability for him where, and it's matured, I think, from last season to this season. And Alex, you may remember looking at the qualifying round last year when people were starting to question the lack of lineup changes. He made a comment about putting the guys on the ice each night that he thinks have the best chance to win the game for the team. And we all kind of thought that sounded a little crazy because clearly there were better options. And so I really got the feeling like, oh, maybe he's kind of losing touch with this whole being open and honest kind of thing with the media. But you saw this season, I think, you know, you saw him after game two be really, I don't want to say confrontational, but he was very straightforward about, you know, look, you're leveling criticisms and I don't agree with them. I don't appreciate it and kind of done here for the night. But the next day, just after getting a chance to get home, get a night of sleep, that's when he made those comments about making changes. And it's almost like, you know, once the anger had subsided, he and the rest of the coaching staff were able to come together and say, okay, what's the problem? What happened? And instead of just saying, clearly we did nothing wrong, it must be the players, they did say, okay, we've got to do something different. We've got to play a little bit differently. What do we need to do? And like Nick said, I don't think you see a lot of that. And I think if you look at his messaging from the beginning of the season, the things that he was talking about back when the team was still kind of married to that point shot mentality, he never wavered in what his vision was for the team. And it took a while for the team to catch up to that. But I think if you look at what's happened toward the end of the season, everybody got on board with it. And again, we mentioned earlier, it's moving back from the that aspect at the beginning of the season where, you know, we're not married to that Laviolette style anymore.
I just want to throw something out there real quick before we can move on after that if you want. But I just wanted to say, so like, I've only covered two coaches. I've covered Laviolette and now Hines. I start my first year covering the team was Laviolette's first year in 2014-15. And the difference like could not be bigger. I mean, there's such a massive difference in how they kind of run their teams. I think of it like this. I think of Laviolette as just like a dictator, as like an authoritarian dictator. He wants to control every aspect of his team, from the media side, from the internal side, from the front office side. He basically probably told David Poyle to go get Zach Rinaldo. I can't imagine David Poyle thinking that was a good idea. Like, he basically just wanted to control every aspect of that team. But the problem is, if you lose the locker room and you're the control guy, you're the authoritarian, and you lose that locker room, that's when things go really bad quickly. And that's what happened. The reason I think Hines is better is he's much more of a facilitator. Like, I'm going to lead this ship, but I'm going to put you in charge of the sales, and I'm going to put this guy in charge of swabbing the deck, and this guy's going to be my right-hand man. This guy's my navigator. This guy's he's a delegator. He's a facilitator of the whole system. And it's not a way to like avoid accountability. I think it's the only way to do it. Like, you can't be in control of everything. You can't be the guy that like is ultimately responsible for everything. And rely on your internal leadership and make those leaders step up and play their role on the team, which I think you have to be happy with that if you're a fan of this team, like thinking that John Hines might be the guy for the future, because I think that that's a good way to approach it.
You know what? I think that we really kind of underestimate how much of a Ted Lasso teams really need sometimes.
That's a great point, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. You know, speaking of coaches and saying stuff to the press, does anybody really think that what Rod Brindamore said about the officiating played a big role in the series?
I don't.
Is anybody willing to die on that hill?
No.
Okay. I mean, it became a thing, I think, just because people in articles and on Twitter were making it a thing. But, I mean... the officiating was inconsistent, I'll say that, but I don't think it was a situation where one person swayed it or anything like that.
No, and I think you got a chance, though, with that complaint from Brindamore to see the difference in those two coaches. And you get to see Brindamore, which a lot of people have argued, and I mean, they're not necessarily wrong. That's just gamesmanship on his part. You know, like if he can bring that element into it where the refs are starting to question, oh, do I need to call this? Should I not call this? And is he really giving his team an advantage that they don't even have to worry about, you know, from the player side of things? But, you know, Brendan Moore wanted to make excuses, even when his team won a game, which seemed really odd to me. But, you know, Hines stuck on that message of we're going to control what we can control. And we're not going to worry about anything else. And I think that, you know, you talk about the coach for the future of your team or the coach moving forward. That's the kind of attitude I want out of a coach. I want him to inspire the players not to complain about petty things, but just focus on, okay, adversity comes our way. We deal with it. We go on. And speaking of Ted Lasso, I just started watching that right before we recorded this. So I'm really excited to finish it now.
So we got to make sure we don't drop any spoilers.
I think Ted Lasso might be my favorite. Like, people talk about their favorite, like, sports movies. It might be if you consider that a movie, because it kind of is, it's like a, you know, eight whatever part series. Like, it would be one of my favorite sports movies at this point.
I can't wait to finish watching
it. It's fantastic.
As soon as we're done with this, it's going to be incredible.
Especially given this conversation.
It's the sports fans version of Schitt's Creek. It really is. Just the show that makes you feel good.
I haven't watched that yet either.
Well, you sound like you need to clear out the old DVR sometime soon.
Well, I'll do what I can.
Well, let's move forward. Well, actually, before we do, one last thing. Does anybody want to say anything about Carolina's social media? I don't know why that became a thing, but does anybody want to comment on it?
Yeah, I'll say something. And I guess, Alex, you're probably not a part of this, but, you know, all of us softies over here at On the Forecheck, you know, I look at that posts from the Kane social media. And, you know, Banner jokes, they're not really funny anymore. Like, I don't get them. I don't think it just doesn't make sense to keep beating that dead horse when every single team has banners like that hanging from their rafters, including Carolina. You know, if you want to get really crazy here, you could take a look at the banners they do have. And one of them does say Stanley Cup champions, and that's great. But I guarantee you, after they get knocked out of this playoff series, they're going to raise a banner next year, and it's probably going to say something about being the division champions or something like that. And so it's fine and dandy to say, oh yeah, a few years ago they hung up three banners and they didn't win the cup. Okay, cool, great story. But that, to me, like, that's just, you know, it's clown shoes. It's not funny. People just expect it at this point. So, you know, you wear the clown shoes. Nobody goes, oh my God, look at that clown shoes. They're incredibly big and red. What a hilarious comedic thing. I can't stop laughing. But you just expect, you know, trash people to make trash jokes at this point. So there's that. But then the thing that got me was, and for everything I've heard and everything I understand, it was a Photoshop job that prompted the whole thing about the Preds blocking them on Instagram. And so, you know, that was, I don't know, there's a lot of backlash to that. A lot of people saying, oh, the Preds social media lost or whatever. But I don't know. It's weird to, you know, the number one rule in comedy from everything I've always heard, and I've watched a lot of comedy, I've listened to a lot of comedians talk, you never punch down, you always punch up. So if you want to punch on an equal footing while you're playing a team, that's fine. But when that series is over and those players shake hands on the ice, that should be the end of it. You want to attack after that, you're just punching down, and that's just a bad look, in my opinion. Maybe I'm wrong.
Well, only thing I'll add is about the banner thing. One thing is, first of all, it's not that original of a tweet. Like, half of hockey Twitter has made Photoshop versions of a banner of Nashville saying whatever insert joke here. They're just the first social media account to do it. So, like, first of all, you lose points for originality. Not that good of a tweet. Secondly, the banner thing, like, yeah, I will never understand why people care about how one team decides to decorate their building. Like, why do you care? If we want to put a banner that says most hot dogs consumed at a hockey game, who cares? Go for it. Like, I don't care. On that note, yes, you're right. Like, Chicago, the United Center, the American Airlines Center, Dallas, the TD Garden in Boston, all of these places have Stanley Cup banners, and they also have, like, regular season conference banners and division banners and all that stuff. So, like, it's stupid. Like, why does Nashville get criticized for it? Because they don't have a Stanley Cup banner yet. That's the only reason.
Yeah. I mean, it's the end of the day, it's a social media account trolling another team to get a few clicks, get a few likes. You know, it's whatever. I mean, it's, I think there are other jokes out there if you wanted to make Nashville jokes, but we don't want to be called soft, so let's move on to the next topic.
You've got
to
be hard.
Got to be hard.
Be hard.
According to the one guy on Twitter.
Well, no, there were two more, but they were just late entries to the contest. Either way,
it was by a guy who skipped leg day. So,
if we
want to talk about going hard, do some squats, pal. I'm sure I'll get a tweet for that. Hey, the off season's coming up. And this is one that's going to be interesting for David Poile. We're going to talk about specific players here in a little bit, but, you know, I've been following the team since they came in, and I can't remember an off season where there's just so much happening that could have a ripple effect on a lot of players. And let's start with the expansion draft, because that's going to be what seems like the first order of business. Alex, I'll ask with you, because I think this was you on Twitter that mentioned this the other day. Back in 2017, it was a pretty easy expansion list for the Preds. I mean, it was just a matter of Yarncroke versus Neil. Which one did you like better? This year, there's just so many directions that you can go.
Yeah. Yeah. In 2017, it was a pretty simple. It wasn't simple in the fact that I think the Predators were worried they were going to lose someone. I mean, I think it's different now because I think they're kind of wanting Seattle to take someone in particular. But yeah, Vegas was a very difficult situation for them because they didn't want to lose James Neal. They didn't want to use Cal Yarncroke. They didn't want to lose anyone else. But the rules were the rules, and Vegas wouldn't return their phone calls. So they were just kind of SOL, and they lost James Neal. This is different because David Poile has an incentive now to really work with Seattle. And I would think that Ron Francis, the GM for Seattle, will want to listen to what David Poile has to say because Poile's going to want to sweeten the pot for them to take a high-dollar contract, whether it be Matt Duchene, Ryan Johansson. I could see them trading someone like Ryan Ellis. I could see them getting rid of Victor Arvidsson's contract. Not that it's a bad one, just because I think they might try to trade him. And they'll sweeten the pot. You know, we'll give you a draft pick. We'll give you a prospect to take one of these two guys. So like, or one of these, any number of guys. So yeah, it's very different. I'm really interested to see what their protection list is going to be. However, keep in mind the protection list might not matter because if they have a deal in place, you know, it doesn't matter who they expose. They're already telling them to pick a certain player. Tons of teams did that with Vegas. But again, they probably didn't have any leverage. And so George McPhee never picked up the phone.
I guess the thing for me, and this is a question that I have, and maybe this is just me, maybe everybody knows this and I don't. Is there an order that they're going to have to pick in? Like, do they have to start with a certain team and then go to the next team? Or is there?
I don't think it's like an official draft. I think it's just You look at each team's list and kind of pick and choose.
I want to say it's alphabetical. I think they just like on the night of the actual expansion draft, like all the teams are just in order alphabetically.
Okay. That's how Vegas was, but I'm sure it's, I think it's like you have to pick X number of forwards, X number of defensemen.
How it'll work like functionally is on the 17th, 4 days before the draft, all the teams submit their protection lists, their official lists.
Okay.
And then everyone speculates about who's going to pick who or who they're going to pick. And then the actual draft and they announce who they're going to pick. And, you know, it's just like, it's not the most riveting, television, but.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess it's not the same as like the amateur draft or anything, but
yeah,
I guess the thing is it's, you have to base what the Predators are going to lose in this or what they're going to choose from Nashville on what they're going to choose from everybody else. And I'm not like, I don't have the breadth of knowledge needed on every single team and every single team's like protection. Like it's hard for me to make that decision and say, well, based on what they're going to do with everybody else, this is what they're going to do with Nashville. So, you know, if I'm looking at it, yeah, you want to shed a big contract. And in every conversation anyone's ever had with me, like, well, what do you think is going to happen? I'm like, well, you know, $8 million would be a really nice chunk of change to spend, you know, in the off season, if you were looking at rebuilding this team, and this may be one of your last really good chances to deal someone like that. But I also have to think too, you know, you mentioned trading Ellis and Ellis is my son's favorite player and he would be absolutely heartbroken. My wife has already had conversations with him about it. It's not a good situation, but
I don't think that's going to happen, by the way. I threw that name out there. It's a possibility, but like I would guess probably four or five other guys first.
True. But you have to, you know, there is a major log jam in this team's defense where you have so many prospects down at the lower levels that want a chance. I mean, Carrier's been in Milwaukee for years. You know, the first thing I ever did when I started on the forecheck was I went to like the Future Stars camper or whatever they call that. And I was really excited to see Carrier. I wanted to see how he played. I expected to see him coming up to Nashville soon. And that was after the cup run. That was the 2017-2018 season. And you're looking at him getting his first real shot in 2021. And that to me shows you how big of a logjam there is defensively to where the team may need to make some room in their defensive core to be able to get some of these guys moved up. Or conversely, that could be someone that you're trading in order to sweeten the pot on someone else as one of your really strong defensive prospects, which I'm tired of getting rid of really strong defensive prospects. But
That's why I like any conversation I have about this. And I'm sure you get questions too, Sean. I just think the emphasis should be on David Poile working a deal so that the protection list doesn't matter.
Right.
Because like there's so many options. Like, I mean, if you look, if you just really try to dive in and like, should they do eight skaters or should they do seven forwards, three defensemen? Like you are going to have heartbreak over who's exposed because like, it's just impossible to like, you're going to lose Elie Tolvanen or you're going to lose Dante Fabbro or Alex Carrier, or you're going to lose Victor Arvidsson, or you're going to lose name your guy, Jakob Trenin. He could be taken. I mean, like there's so many options that Seattle could just like pilch from you. And that's why I think he has to get on the phone and work a deal. And he might've already done that because he seems very confident in that he's already got it figured out.
He does.
Yeah. I mean, you've heard him say that, right? Like he seems like pretty sure that he's already knows what he's going to do. So I wonder if he's already got a deal in place, which would be good. And I think that would be, that's the best way to do it. He's got to work a deal so that he's not in a guessing game on the day of.
Yeah. He doesn't want to be caught in that situation again. And I really think I think David Poile's future kind of hinges on managing this well, in my opinion.
Right. And we're running a little short on time, so I want to keep this brief, but there's two points I wanted to bring up. One, to echo what Alex said, if you're ever going to make a deal, this is the draft year you want to do this because A, it's not a strong draft class and you have a mid first round pick. And two, this is kind of a quick question I want an answer to. We saw some teams get fleeced back in 2017. I mean, the Wild lost both Alex Tuck and Eric Howla.
Yeah.
Florida lost more or less everyone.
They lost a ton of guys.
They lost a ton of guys trying to keep. I think Alex Petrovic was the fourth defenseman they wanted to keep, and they wound up losing Marchessault and Riley Smith. Anaheim obviously lost Shea Theodore. I still have Jose Theodore on my mind whenever I see the name Theodore on the ice. So I want to, real quick, want to ask, do you think some of that storyline from 2017 is going to change how GMs approach this year's expansion draft? Do you think they're going to be any more or less cautious because of that?
So I think that, I don't know about that, but I do know that Seattle will probably try to follow the same route that Vegas did. And if you remember, Vegas just acquired so much draft capital. They had so many draft picks in that draft and then in the next two drafts where they got all kinds of really good players. Like they acquired so much draft capital. So if Seattle is smart, and that's a good thing to do, if Seattle's smart, they will definitely talk to people who are willing to send them draft picks in order to not select certain players.
I'm going to keep it real brief because I think every move every GM has made since the Vegas draft has been with eyes on the Seattle draft.
Interesting. And I don't disagree with that. But we're going to get into a little bit more of this in just a few seconds. We're going to take a quick break. Alex, I don't know if you know this, but we have a tradition here on the Forecheck podcast. Well, we started it after you left the On the Forecheck podcast.
Uh-huh.
We have a trivia question going to break.
Okay.
So this one is for you and Sean. We've had a lot of overtime games this past playoff series. So there's two players tied in Predators history for most playoff overtime points. Can you name the two players? Think about it and give me an answer on the other side of the break. Welcome back, everybody. Before the break, I asked what two players have the team record for most career playoff overtime points. Do you guys have any guesses?
Okay, so I can name almost all the goals. So, like, I know Kevin Fiala had two. I know Craig Smith had one. Mike Fisher had one. Obviously, Matt Duchene had one. And, now I've forgotten who just scored the other one.
Luke Cunningham.
Luke Cunningham, yes. This is definitely not Luke Cunningham. He only has one. I mean, I think an educated guess would be one of the two defensemen, either Ekholm or Josi. But I'll let Sean do some figuring as well.
I was going to say the safe bet would be Yossi, and then the backup was also going to be Ekholm. So I think beyond that, if you get past those two, you know, I don't know, that seems right to me, but I don't know.
Well, I'm thinking, hold on, let me commit to my name here. So Fiala had two goals, and I'm trying to think, he wouldn't have been on the line with, he wasn't in town when Craig Smith scored that one. I don't think he was out there when Mike Fisher scored either. So he would just have two, but two might be enough. I'm going to go with Kevin Fiala.
Sean?
I'm going to go with Yossi.
Well, your guy, one of your guesses were both right. Matthias Ekholm.
Ah.
Three assists. Mm. The other one you did not get.
Oh.
And this, here's a hint. He has not scored a goal. All three of his points have been secondary assists.
Wow.
Huh.
Is it Ryan Ellis?
He is our beloved manager's favorite player.
I'm
Callie Yarncroke.
Oh, Callie Yarncroke. Oh, okay. Of course it's Callie Yarncroke.
Callie Yarncroke and Matthias Ekholm each have three assists. That 3 points is tied for the most playoff points of all time.
Go.
And by beloved manager, you mean Kate, right?
I do mean Kate.
Okay.
Yes. I was confused. I was like, David Poyle's favorite player?
I didn't know. I mean, he does love some Callie Yarncroke. Also, fun fact, one of the players tied for second, Nick Spaulding. There is not an answer.
Yeah, he definitely assisted on the Smithson goal.
He did the Smithson goal and the Hallishuk goal. So pretty good playoff run for that line. All right. Well, as we mentioned earlier, probably a good chance there's going to be some roster turnover this year. There's expansion. There's a chance for a big trade. Probably not a buyout, but, you know, weirder things have happened. So I want to play a game with you two. I'm going to give you guys a Preds player. You guys tell me in a percentage number how likely you think that player is on the team next year. So for example, if I said Roman Yossi, one of you might say 99.9 chance he's on the team next year because I don't think Roman Yossi is leaving the Nashville Predators unless Connor McDavid's available or something weird. So that's how we go. Are you guys ready?
This has really strong potential to show up on like Old Takes Exposed or something.
Hey, publicity is good publicity. As long as we don't get called soft, I think we're good.
Oh, you gotta be hard.
Gotta be hard on this, guys.
Yeah.
All right. Player one, Mikael Granlund. Alex, you first.
Mikael Granlund. All right. So percentage chance that he's on the team next year. I think he's actually pretty good. I would not be surprised if Mikael Granlund wants to come back and if they are able to offload some money that they have the money to sign him, even if it's a pay increase. He was a huge part of this team in the regular season, especially when they were really bad. I'm going to go 75% that he's going to be on the team.
For all of the same reasons that Alex just gave, I'm going to say 64%.
Because of his number?
Oh.
Mainly.
It's like Yossi making, what was it, $9.059 million for his debut. I'm with you guys. I think it's probably, I'm going to say 70% he's back because I think both sides want him back. Let's stick with the unrestricted free agent from Finland category, Erik Haula.
I'm going to say 0%. Okay, not 0, 5%. 5% that he'll be back.
Why? Why you say 5%?
I don't think that they're going to want to keep him. I think that they had too many other pieces that can fit in. I think it was a good experiment. I don't think he was bad, but like I think they have too many other pieces that they probably want to move up. I don't think it makes any sense.
So, quick side question, and I don't know, maybe Nick's going to tell us we can't talk about this right now, but do you think that signing Haula was a big part of getting Granlund to come back?
Huh.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I just I don't know. I wonder if that's like a package deal. Like, okay, you know, I'm really interested in re-signing. You're going to keep my boy Eric here, or do I need to go somewhere else? Like, I don't know. I don't know if he's going to pull something like that, but I've always wondered, because it seemed like those two signings came really close to each other.
It could be a factor.
I don't know.
I don't think it's a Parise suitor situation, or when USC basketball recruited Little Romeo so they can get DeMar DeRozan. But, you know, I think they talked. I think they just said, hey, this is a decent place if you want to try.
Maybe.
I'm definitely not denying that it could be true. Like, there could be something to that. Yeah.
So I don't know, but I think you're probably right. I think there's a much smaller chance of him being on the team than Granlund next year. So I'd say you're probably about right. I'd make it a little bit higher, maybe 5.6%.
I'm going to go 5% too, for the same reasons. And it's not that I don't think it's not the fact that they don't like Eric Howler or anything like that. I just think there's other options that you can put there from within. Let's go to a restricted free agent who has been kind of up and down on the Twitter talk, Ben Harper.
I guess I'll bite first on this one. I think you have too many defensive prospects that you'd rather have on the team at this point. I feel like Harper is able to come in and play a role. I was really surprised that role involved being on the Predators, but with the AHL situation, I guess it made sense. So I'm going to say you've probably got 10% chance of him being back. I know they liked what he brought to the team, but I don't know. You saw a lot of issues that you could really clear up with some fresher, maybe more talented defenders.
I would go significantly higher than that. I think it's like a 50-50 on Ben Harper coming back. And that's really mostly just because John Hines likes him a lot. So played him 5 games in the series, played a lot down the stretch. He's an RFA, so he'll be cheap. They need cheap contracts. I think it's a pretty good shot that he makes it. I don't know how much he would play, because like, I think if they're really going to give, continue to give guys like Davies and Ferentz and even Lewington a shot next year, he probably won't play a lot, but I think he's probably back and he'll be cheap. So,
yeah, I think it's a situation where he's probably going to at least start on the team. So I'm actually going to go 90% on this.
Wow.
I think they like Harper. I don't know if he finishes the season in Nashville, but I think he's definitely going to be on the roster at the start of next year. Do we want to waste time, Eric Goodbranson, or do we all just want to say 0%?
Probably zero. Probably like maybe 1%.
Yeah, I'm with you on that one.
Yeah, it's, you know, good guy from all accounts. Just I don't think he's going to be a long-term thing. All right, who's ready to get juicy?
Oh,
let's do it.
Ryan Johansson.
All right, so I think of all the options for who is going to play in Seattle next year, Ryan Johansson makes the most sense. I don't want to go back through the whole expansion draft thing again, but I think that there's a chance that he's the guy that goes to Seattle, because that's what Seattle would need. They're okay taking on $8 million a year. It's only $8 million for 4 more years. I think that they'd probably be willing to do that. So I think it's less than a third. I think it's like, let's say a third. There's a 33.3333% chance that he's on the Predators next year.
I would say, you know, I understand where your percentage is coming from. I'm going to say 50-50, because I feel like this is either the guy that goes to Seattle or they just go in a totally different direction.
I'm going to be a little more optimistic than both of you. I'm going to go 75%, and we're going to get into why, because I think the Preds are going to want somebody else on the expansion block. But I also think that the Preds really like what they saw from Johansson, especially towards the end of the year. And I think they want to see what they have in that Forsberg-Johansson-Duchesne combo. So I'm going to go 80% for Ryan Johansson. This is a guy who we really didn't think would be on the roster this far a couple months ago, Mattias Ekholm. Yeah, there's some layers to this one.
Yeah, I think pretty high. I think 75% that he'll be on the team.
This is a guy that you could realistically build a team around. I think, you know, if you are Seattle, this is a guy you could look at and say, oh, we need to get this guy. I mean, he has strong leadership potential. You could look at him as a potential captain in year one in Seattle, in my opinion. And realistically, you know, he's a guy that is good for the room without being a detriment on the ice. Like there's a lot of guys you hear about being great in the locker room, but don't really bring much on the ice. I think he's everything you would want in the locker room as well as on the ice, total package. So if you're the Predators, as David Poile said, he's not going to lose him in expansion. I don't know that he ends up going anywhere else. I'm going to say 100% chance he's on the team next year.
Hmm.
I am going to go 75%. I'm leaning towards Sean just because I think they want him on the roster. I think they know how important he is. I mean, I think there's an argument to be made. He was the best defenseman on the team throughout the entire scope of the season. But he also has a contract coming up. And if there's any indication that he may not resign or maybe non-committal, you might need to pull the trigger on a trade. So not going 100%, but I think it's probably a 75% chance.
And I want to say, too, something about Ekholm is when he signed his last contract, it was very team-friendly. And he even made the comment that that was more than enough money for him, that he wasn't going to retire and go live some extravagant lifestyle. And so you've got to wonder – you know, he was willing to take the discount the first time around. Is he willing to take it the second time around if he really wants to stay in Nashville? And I feel like of just about anybody on the team that has the ability and the skill to make big money, he's probably the one that would be the most willing to take that team friendly deal.
I don't disagree with you there. All right. Next up, another defenseman, Dante Fabbro.
So I think it's pretty clear at this point, Alex Kyrie has passed him. I know we talked a little bit about that, but, you know, if they were to do the eight skaters route, for example, with Seattle, I think they'd protect Alex Kyrie before they protected Dante Fabbro. But that doesn't mean he's going to go to Seattle either. So, you know, he's a good defenseman. He's still got some growing to do. I think he's probably on the team. I think that they figure out a way to not have him be taken by Seattle, and they sign him because he's due a contract, or he's not RFA rather. And I think he's on the team. I think probably pretty, I'd go pretty high. I mean, 80%, 85%.
I've got to wonder with some of the comments that were made, I don't remember who said it, but it was something about that he had a very large role in the future of this team. And there's a part of me that wonders if that's like a total chess move in saying like, this is the guy we're going to offload to, you know, make to sweeten the pot with another team. You know, in which case, if that's it, you know, why are you not playing him in the playoffs? But there's a part of me that really feels like there may be something to that. And so I'm going to say that there's a 57% chance that he's on this team next year.
Okay. What are we going to happen if we get to Matt Duchene and he's not a 95% chance of coming back?
There's decimals.
There you go. On Fabbro, I agree with Alex. I don't necessarily think he's a guy that they're going to rush to protect or bend over backwards to protect. And at the same time, I think if he's somebody who winds up on an expansion list, he's an attractive option for Seattle to pick, but I don't think they're going to go that route. I am going to go 80% because I do think Dante Fabbro has a place in the Predators' future. Matt Duchene, the other big center and big contract that might be on the block.
I feel pretty confident he's going to be back. 95.
Oh, I see what you're doing.
Okay.
Oh, man.
Well, okay, so just real quick, the reason, go, any of the stats people, just go look at his on ice impact, 5-on-5, like his shot charts. It's unreal. Like, he had such a good underlying shot metrics, like all over the place in the offensive zone last year and this year. It would be stupid not to have him back. Like, he's not. The demise has been greatly exaggerated.
I agree with that statement. What was, if we can go back, and I don't know if you wrote these down or not, and my memory is not that good. What percentage did you give Johansson of being on the team next year?
Me?
Yeah.
A third, 33%.
30. Okay. So you're kind of thinking along the lines of, if they're going to jettison an $8 million dollar year contract, it's going to be Johansson's. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Okay. I see where your head is. I was making sure that you didn't give a very high chance to both of those guys and say, so you think they're both going to be on the team, because what are they going to do and how are they going to have money to spend? But
sounds like, yeah, Alex prepared better than you did, Sean.
Well, you know, there's a lot.
I really didn't actually.
But you know, you saying it and speaking it into existence makes everyone think that it's true. I have a spreadsheet. No, I'm kidding. I'm not prepared at all. But no, the thing with Duchesne is, I think, you know, exactly what Alex said is true. And, you know, this is a guy that, okay, so he didn't score 600 goals. He had a really good season numbers wise. He had a really good season. If you look at the advanced stats, this is a guy who's always doing on the ice exactly what you need done. So I think there's a strong chance he'll be back. I'm not going to name any names, took my percentage, which is just frustrating, but it's okay. So I'm going to say there is a 95.95% chance that he's back on the team.
I thought you were going to go like 95.01, like Price.
Or like the Price is Right. Like,
yeah. I won't say too much, because I'm with you guys. I think they like Duchesne. I'm going to go 95% as well. Okay, here's the big one. Victor Arvidsson. And I think we've hinted at some of this already.
Ooh.
Yeah, I do not think he'll be back. I think they're going to trade him. Let's go 7%. 7% that he's on the team next year.
Can I ask what makes you so sure they're going to trade him?
I just don't see any route for him to be on this team, like, moving forward. It doesn't, he's struggled to make sense in the John Hines system. He's not a creator, and his only game is offense, and he can't create on his own. He's just a volume shooter that relies on playmakers to get him the puck, and those playmakers are worrying about themselves, like trying to generate offense. I think he's also a little bit kind of coming down from his 30 goal seasons. But I also think he's got a reasonable cap hit, and someone out there is going to want to take a chance. They need to trade him while his value is still pretty high. And they have Rocco Grimaldi, who is a kind of a different version of Victor Arvidsson, not as skilled, but that definitely has the speed and the forechecking ability to do that. And then they have Rocco Grimaldi under contract. So I think Victor Arvidsson will be traded for several reasons.
Yeah, and I think, too, there's going to be a lot of teams out there who have forwards that cost a lot of money that aren't producing, that might look at him as an option to say, you know, we could probably get about the same production out of this guy for a lot less money. So you may be right. What was the percentage you gave?
Seven.
Seven?
7%.
I think I know where Sean's going with this.
You're fairly certain that he's going to be traded then. Okay. Well, I don't know. I hate to commit to a number, but, you know, probably somewhere around, I mean, your number is pretty close. Maybe 9.9%.
You didn't go 33% or 3.3?
I went 3.3 times 3.
Wow. Okay. I just had to think about that to do the math in my head for a second.
Sorry.
Remember when I said that I think the Preds are going to try to dangle somebody else on the expansion draft? I think it's Arvidsson. And whether or not he winds up in Seattle or whether he gets traded, I don't see a spot for him long term. I think Ellie Tolvanen is playing the role that they want Arvidsson to play, but he's playing it a little better than Arvidsson, or at least has a little bit more upside in that spot. I also don't think Arvidsson has been the same since he's come back from the Bortuzzo hit.
No.
And it's not even that he's lost a step. I think he's just playing a little bit different. The confidence to get to the net isn't there. He's a guy that I think still has a lot to offer a team. I just think he needs a change of scenery to do that. I'm going to go 10%. 10% for...
So your price is riding me, in other words.
Yes. Well, that, okay. That's what you get for doing the 3.3.
Oh, fine. Whatever. I was trying to be creative.
This can go either way. Philip Forsberg. Is anybody going to make a big pitch about him maybe being moved?
No.
Go ahead, Sean.
No, I'm not. I don't think he's going to be moved.
No, he'll be 100%. I would go right alongside with Roman Josi. 100% Philip Forsberg will be on the team next year.
Yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah. I'm going to say 95 just because of the contract situation. Who knows what's going to happen. But I agree. I think they are going to move hell and high water to try to get Philip Forsberg to stay a long time. So
yeah,
actually I'll go higher than 95. I'll go 98% on wow. Forsberg. This is a situation we talked about earlier. Alex Carrier, expansion eligible.
Yeah, I think he'll be on the team. I think that they would even protect him. I think that if it came down to it, they'd protect him over Fabro. So I'd say whatever I said for Ekholm, I think I said 80-something. So probably 85% that Alex Carrier is on the team.
I'm trying to think of a creative number. Well, you know, I'm with you on that. I'd say the exact same thing you said, Alex. I think there's a strong chance that he's going to be on the team. I think they liked what they saw out of him enough that they would probably be willing to protect him, even over Fabro.
Yeah, I mean, I'm gonna say 80% on Carrier for the loan purpose or for the loan reason that it's not 90% or higher. Is that if for some reason David Poile can't get a deal done with Seattle, then I think Carrier is somebody who might be on the block and is somebody I think Seattle would target.
Yeah.
But that's it. Same vein, Colton Sissons.
I can't see them trading him. I can't see him being selected by Seattle. He's obviously under contract for a long time. He's got a reasonable cap hit, a big part of the fourth line. I'd go 90%. 90% he's on the team.
I can see that argument. And it's a name that I've heard several people say, oh, they might lose Sissons. They might lose Sissons. But I don't think that you sign him to the contract you sign him to, and not so much for the price, but for the term on it, and think that that's a piece you're going to move. Not so much because, you know, oh, well, you want him on the team forever, but because I don't know that an expansion team is going to want to take on that long of a contract. It just seems like a bit much to put down, or a long commitment to someone who's been playing on the fourth line. And I think, too, you know, he's someone that has been on the team for a long time, has been through the ups and downs with the team, and is familiar enough with how things need to be done to do things quote unquote the Predator way, that he's someone now that is a veteran presence that works really well with the youth when they come up. And I think that's going to be very valuable to the team moving forward. So I'd say, you know, somewhere between 90 and 95.
I'm going to go 90%. Again, possible expansion target. I don't see Seattle picking him, but at the same time, it also depends on who else is available around the league and if they need a bottom pair guy. It's hard to find another one who's been as consistent as Colton Sissons in that situation. Two more. Callie Yarncroke. Anybody see him going anywhere?
No. They already protected the guy from one Seattle draft. And I know it's not only about that, but or expansion draft rather, but No, he's back. Kalyan Croak is back. 90%.
There's nothing I can do creatively unless I put his number backwards and make it 91%.
There we go.
Mm.
Ooh. Yeah. Gonna go 90% on Yarn Croak for same reasons we've talked about with other players. Last one. Get the tissues out.
Oh god.
Pekka Rinne. What do we see his future looking like?
So I think obviously we're answering, is he going to be back in the Predators? I think it's pretty low. I think nothing above 10%. And that's obviously, that's changed because I think at one point in the year, you know, no one knew, it wasn't clear, but that last game, like it just had that the sort of air of finality to it. I mean, like, he didn't have to, you know, do all that and wave and take it in and skate around. Like, he kind of just had that happen. Like, he could have just been like, no, I'm going back inside. We're done here. Because he did that, I feel like he does feel like it's the end. He's just being cagey with his answers on what he's going to do. No idea where he's going to be, but I think it's pretty unlikely that he's back in Nashville next year. Not as a skate. Now, some people have made the guess that he's going to come back and work with the Predators in some capacity, a goalie coach or talent scout or what, I don't know what else. Maybe that happens, but not as a player, not as a goaltender on the ice.
Yeah, I'm a little bit older than Pekka Rinne. I think by 3 years. Is he 38 now? Is that right? Yeah, I'm 3 years older than Pekka Rinne, and you know, my kids are older than his kids, and I can only imagine that if I, you know, 3 years ago had my first child and I was at that point in a career that takes me away from home quite often and requires a lot of my time outside of me actually doing my job, that requires that much of a commitment. You know, Pekka loves Finland. He goes back all the time. I feel like he's at a point where he's ready to say, you know what, I've got a son, I've got a family. It's time to go back to Finland for a while and just be a dad, and not to UC, but you know, an actual father to my son.
Here and for his son, UC Soros.
You know, he's made pretty good money. I don't think it's a situation where he's like, if I could just squeeze one or two more years out, you know, maybe $2 million a year, I'd be set. I think he's fine. And I think, you know, he's got to, on some level, know that if it is the glory of a Stanley Cup that he's chasing, that it probably doesn't come next season, at least not in Nashville. And so I feel like if at this point in your career with a brand new child, do you really want to move to another city and start over as far as playing? Probably not. And so I feel like this is his opportunity to make a very graceful exit from the stage and just go back and be a dad for a while. I'm going to say, I have to give a percentage. Yeah, it's going to be pretty low, you know, maybe 10, 15, something like that.
3.5 was right there, man.
Yeah, so it's too low.
Yeah. I was on the fence about this because everybody kind of thought this was going to be Pekka's last year before the season even started. There was reports coming out that he's going to look in Finland. You know, the press countered that by saying they haven't talked contract. You know, they're going to talk, see if there's any interest there, but just everything about that last game seemed like a farewell, not just for the fans where Pekka took a lap, but you look at how his teammates were responding, you know, giving him the curtain call and coming in back out to give him the big send off. I think this is it for Pekka in Nashville. I don't think he stays in the NHL because I don't think he wants to play for a team other than the Preds. I think he goes back to Finland for a couple of years, kind of do what Pavel Datsyuk did, raise the family in his home country. And that's fine. I think that's the way Pekka Rinne got his send-off. You couldn't write a Hollywood script better than that. So I'm going to say Rene leaves on a high note, and I'm going to say 3.5%. He's back next year. If you
there didn't you go.
Want it, Sean, I was going to take it.
Okay, fine. It's yours.
All right. Well, that's our list, everybody. And I think that's probably a good place to wrap up the show.
We haven't even argued about food.
I know. It's Alex, you missed the entire French fry debate.
Oh.
What was that?
Oh.
How
much time do you have?
I'm going to phrase this just straight up so we can get a straight up answer. What do you think of McDonald's fries?
I like them.
Thank you.
They're not my favorite, but I enjoy them.
You're going to mute my microphone, aren't you?
Yeah. I'm going to erase you from this entire podcast.
No.
This will just be Nick and Alex.
Nick and Alex's McDonald's fry fan podcast.
Yeah. Like I said, we're trying to get a sponsorship from somebody.
Well, I prefer the meat choices at Arby's. I hear they have the meats.
If there's anybody else out there who wants to sponsor us,
if there is a barbecue company, a barbecue restaurant, look, I will come eat your barbecue and I will talk about it a lot.
Peg leg porker,
anybody. Just dude on the corner with a smoker. Like, I don't care if you want me to talk about your barbecue. Just hit me up on the Twitter.
I thought you were going to go when you mentioned the guy in the corner. I thought you were going to go the hot dog guy. That's always up there on like Third Avenue.
Huh? There's a hot dog guy on Third Avenue.
There is a hot dog guy.
Oh,
I've had them before.
Well, sounds good. I'll eat that too. It's not barbecue, but whatever. Uh-huh. Or wrap that hot dog in bacon and we're talking.
That sounds like either state fair fodder or something I eat if I want to give myself a fatal heart attack.
Oh, well, that's ugly, but whatever.
That's a good note to end on. Hey, everybody, that's our show. Alex, thank you for joining us. We had a lot of fun with you on.
Yeah, of course.
Where can the fine people find you?
So, currently I'm in hibernation until hockey season again, so you can't find me anywhere. But if you must, just find me on Twitter at AlexDarty1 and hockey coverage at AtoZSportsNashville.com. Obviously in the off season, we don't put out as much stuff, but of course, like, you know, around the big events, draft, expansion draft, free agency, all that stuff, we'll have stuff out for that. But in general, you can catch me back in action in October.
Sean, where can the good people find you at?
The good people can find me on the Twitter at SCSOTF, and of course you can find me at ontheforecheck.com. I will also say, I put this out on Twitter, kind of at a loss for what I should be talking about here. I mean, I know there's end of the season stuff for the Preds, so if you've got some ideas, you know, again, people have recommended I start talking about brisket, about barbecue. Somebody recommended bourbon, all things that start with B. I'm not a drinker, so I'd have to pass that off to someone else who is. But a lot of good ideas out there. If you have any more, throw them my way. I'll see what I can do.
That sounds like the Chris Martell episode.
I think
he's the resident bourbon master. You can literally. Literally, yes. You can find me _NSMorgan on Twitter. I'm also running the On the Forecheck Twitter account now. So if you see any terrible takes from that account, you're welcome.
It's not an if, it's a when.
Yes, that is very true. There's been a lot of memes and back and forth. I'm the soft guy, everybody. I'm the guy who's soft.
Oh.
But same boat. We'll have some draft coverage coming up. I've got a piece about off-season priorities for David Poile, so check that out in a couple of days. Yeah, it's the off-season, folks. It's going to be a lean one. Thank you for joining us, everybody. We'll be back next week with another episode. Be sure to share, subscribe, whatever you need to do. and enjoy the rest of the playoffs.